Welcome to the Love Letters to Poe podcast. I'm Sarah Crokel Smith, publisher and editor-in-chief, bringing you wonder and terror, romance and horror in this gothic fiction magazine. Each week, I'll be sharing a new gothic story or poem from the pages of Love Letters to Poe. You can find the original stories and poems, author interviews, your free copy of the magazine's inaugural issue, and much more at loveletterstopoe.com. Today's gothic story is titled An Incident on Mulberry Street, read by the author Jackson Cole. The story can be found in Volume 1, Issue 3 of Love Letters to Poe. I hope you enjoy this haunting tale.
An Incident on Mulberry Street, written and narrated by Jackson Cole. The phenomenon of phantom limbs is a common occurrence for survivors of amputation, and as a physician to more than a few men who returned home from the last war less whole than when they rode off, one with which I was well acquainted, patients would report attempting to pick up a jar of jam with a hand they'd left at Gettysburg, or describe trying to scratch a knee last seen before Chancellorsville. One old farmer, an empty shirt sleeve pinned to his shoulder, even swore he could feel the hairs on his arm whenever a breeze blew through his yard. Most of these cases tended to resolve themselves eventually, with either the sensations evaporating over time or, as in the case of the plowman, the survivor learning to live with his invisible appendage. In the latter examples, often the patient reported no pain associated with the injury. The only burden, besides the obvious, was a continual and conscious stifling of any impulse to use the limb. Being a country doctor who served a number of towns in the eastern part of the state, mine was a wide-ranging practice with a large clientele. Yet not all cases of phantom limbs were benign. There were some, I found, in which the patient suffered pain from it. Perceptions of heat or burning were prevalent, or the feeling that the limb was twisted or bent in some awkward position. These sensations I attributed to damage to the nerves located at the site of amputation, known as the neuroma, and beyond my capabilities to remedy. Instead, I referred these gentlemen to a specialist in New Haven, and in every circumstance, they returned from the visit to his office free of discomfort. Dr. Kaufman had been an instructor of mine at the medical college. Much older, he'd served as a surgeon during the war, and from the grim anecdotes shared with his protégés, we understood that he'd performed a significant amount of amputations himself, often under very poor and harrowing conditions. After my degree was conferred, we kept in touch, although less so as the years passed. Still, we remained friendly to each other, and in my rare sojourns into the city, I never failed to meet him for a brandy. It was therefore a little peculiar when, yesterday evening, upon arriving at my house after completing my latest circumlocution through the countryside, I found a telegram from Kaufman waiting for me. It was very brief, as telegrams usually are, hinting at some astonishing breakthrough and asking that I visit him in New Haven as soon as possible. While I'd been gladly anticipating some rest, its urgent tone made ignoring the invitation out of the question. So the following morning I pecked my wife on the cheek, told her I'd be gone for the day, and boarded the shoreline into the city. Having achieved emeritus status at the college, Kaufman had retired into private practice, and he kept an office in a row house along Mulberry Street near the hospital. When he met me at the door, I was taken aback by his appearance. He'd lost weight since our last meeting, and all color had left his hair and beard, leaving it a silvery white. I told myself these were natural signs of aging, and that I hardly looked the same as when I was a student. I have become very self-aware of the gray spreading at my own temples. He invited me to lunch at a nearby cafe, where I observed he ate very little, and after some small gossip about the whereabouts and careers of shared acquaintances, Kaufman began hinting at the source of what I could tell was barely concealed excitement. He asked me if I knew how he relieved the suffering of those patients I sent to him. I confessed that I didn't. The patients themselves gave few details, suggesting the technique was beyond their understanding, and I assumed it involved some relaxation, if not outright removal, of the nerves closest to the neuroma. Kaufman only shook his head and leaned closer to me across the table, concerned we would be overheard. In low tones, he explained his process did not involve nerves at all. Years ago, while working with saw and tourniquet in a blood-soaked Union tent, Kaufman formed a notion that amputation only removed the physical extremity. What remained, he believed, was an ethereal limb that couldn't be sliced away with steel. As the material body was composed of cells, likewise it had an ephemeral counterpart fashioned from an unseen essence. This substance existed alongside our cells, imperceptible to our senses, but detectable by certain instruments of his own invention. In the intervening span, Kaufman had enlarged his theory to the extent he could operate on this invisible aspect of the human body. His technique with my patients, he told me, had been merely to excise the ghostly remnant from the neuroma, just as the physical limb had been cut away before. The discomfort they felt was real because the ethereal limb was real, even if it couldn't be perceived by ordinary methods. By removing the phantom limb, he removed the source of their pain. As I sat listening to him, I was awash with embarrassment and an almost elegiac sadness. Kaufman, once my instructor and even my idol, my friend, had clearly slipped into dementia. His results with my patients were undeniable, yet clearly whatever procedure he employed was now subsumed by this hogwash about wraith-like substances. I knew I could never refer another patient to him. Absurd though his beliefs were, I still felt cordial toward him, so having paid the bill, I agreed to accompany him back to his office, where he wanted to show me something. Kaufman could hardly contain himself as we walked from the cafe. The ethereal limbs he amputated, he said, were not inert tissue. Just as they weren't composed of flesh or muscle, their quintessence eluded definitions of life or death. They were still viable. For the past several years, Kaufman had been engaged in a project to salvage these loose parts, but his final objective was stymied by locating a phantom head. After all, no one can survive having his brain case amputated, he said, and such a thing as a disembodied head was therefore a rarity. As fortune would have it, this difficulty had been solved nearly a week prior, when Kaufman was able to secure what he needed following a gruesome construction accident. Hearing this disclosure, I resolved immediately to contact a colleague I knew at the asylum in Middletown, where my friend Kaufman could live out his remaining years in comfort and safety. Entering his office, we passed through to Kaufman's laboratory, filled with strange mechanisms and dominated in the center by a stout but bare table. A bedsheet lay on the floor beside it. Kaufman, leading the way, stopped very suddenly, and when I looked toward him to gauge the reason, I observed his stare lay exclusively upon the crumpled sheet. As I watched, an expression of panic convulsed across Kaufman's face. His features rippled in contortions so overwhelming that I found myself infected, and in surging dread I glanced around the room, terrified of some danger. But beyond the furniture and machines and that simple square of white cotton, I saw nothing. Suddenly and inexplicably, Kaufman jerked upwards onto his toes. I asked him what the matter was, but in reply he uttered only a strangled gasp. Thinking he had been stricken by a stroke or fit, I sprang forward to aid him. Without warning, I too was struck by something swung heavily at my jaw. A combustion of lights exploded before me, then my vision collapsed, and I remember only darkness as I sprawled to the floorboards. When I came to, I found Kaufman lying before the open doorway. On the far side of the office, the door onto the street also hung unlatched, but more than an hour passed before I realized the strangeness of that, for I distinctly recalled shutting it behind me when we entered from lunch. I crawled to Kaufman to check his pulse. I found none, and my pocket mirror placed before his lips likewise failed to produce any fog on the glass. His eyes bulged in fright, his tongue curled in his mouth like a shriveled black worm. Thinking his heart had seized, my gaze fell lower along his body. It was then that I recoiled from my old friend, shuffling backwards on palms and feet to escape, halted only when I struck a heavy leg of the table behind me. The distance wasn't great enough to obscure the horror of what lay across Kaufman's neck. Striping both sides of his throat were two sets of purple contusions, imprinted on the skin like ink. I counted 10 of them.
If you enjoyed this work of fiction, please show your love by leaving a review. Never miss another story or poem by visiting loveletterstopoe.com/join. And if you want the party to continue, I invite you to Prince Prospero's Masquerade over at patreon.com/loveletterstopoe. Until next time, embrace what lurks in the shadows. You never know what gothic adventure lay within.